So welcome everybody. Good to see some familiar faces, and there are some three, four new people registered. So welcome to you all. So what we'll do, I'll begin, and then Dave will introduce Diane, our presenter today. So last month, we had Paul Waddell, who talked about personal ethics. And so it's a nice connection this month, tonight, to have social ethics, especially as they're expressed through the prophets of the Old Testament. So looking forward to that. I was looking at the Sunday Mass, and I think the opening prayer for this coming Sunday fits what we're doing tonight. So I'll do that, and then David can take over. So let us pray. O God, who teach us that you abide in hearts that are just and true, grant that we may be so fashioned by your grace as to become a dwelling pleasing to you. Amen.
Good. Thank you, Don. It's a joy and a delight to welcome Diane back. We all know she was with us last year, and she set the bar pretty high last year. And because she was so popular, we wanted to invite her back again this year. And I know a lot of you said, oh, I want to be part of it because Diane's great. And where do I sign up? So Diane, your love of the scriptures, the Old Testament always comes forth, and you always make it applicable to us today. We welcome you as you join us tonight. It's good to have you here, and go ahead and take it away.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here, and inviting me back, that's very kind of you. If you open up the website to see that I was speaking, there were a couple of things on that website. At least there was one thing on that website, one sheet of paper on which said Social Ethics of the Prophets. David, would you put it up? Some of you may have it handy, but for the sake of everybody, David will put it up next so that you can see what I'm going to be talking about. It's not really an outline of my talk. It's information that puts what I'm going to talk within a particular context. You really cannot understand the biblical prophets, any of them, unless you understand two very important things, and I have them listed on this paper. First of all, how Israel, ancient Israel, understood covenant. Covenant was, in the ancient world, at the time of ancient Israel, covenant was a very popular, and I use that in a broad sense, not that everybody was happy about it, but it was a very technical format, legal format, of relationship. There were different kinds of covenant. There was a covenant between equals. There's a passage in the Old Testament, may the Lord be between you and me when we are separated from each other. That's considered in biblical circles to be covenant articulation. There's a story also in the Old Testament. I'm Old Testament, so this is what you're going to get tonight. There's a story about the love relationship, the friendship between Jonathan, who was the son of King David. David and Jonathan. Jonathan was the son of King Saul, and David was then the successor of Saul, and they were very, very good friends. And the text in this story about these two men was that they cut a covenant. But that's a covenant between equals. Most of the covenant passages that we find in the Old Testament are between God and the people. Now, in the ancient world, that is not an equal covenant. That's not a mutual covenant. It's a covenant between what we call the suzerain or king and the people under whom or over whom the king ruled. So you have in the ancient world that kind of a suzerainty covenant. Forget the words. It's just a covenant between a king and his subjects or between God and subjects. Most I do not know of any covenant between a queen or between a goddess. It's a patriarchal society, so they understood everything in patriarchal context. So what we have with ancient Israel is a relationship, and it's a legal relationship. Something you have to understand is God had never forced anyone into covenant. God offered covenant. God initiated covenant. But Israel always felt it had a right to say no. But by that, I'm not saying that they sinned. Sin comes much later. But the issue is, will you be my people? That's also covenant language. I will be your God and you will be my people. That's covenant language. And that's a legal contract in the ancient world. There is evidence that the Hittites, a nation north of Israel, used this. We have a Hittite formula. The closest that we have to a covenant formula in the Bible is Exodus 20. And it's a very definite format. First, the God says, identifies himself, and that's in Exodus 20. I am the Lord your God. The second characteristic, the God says and lists all of the things that the God did for the people. And in Exodus 20, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. The third thing is a set of responsibilities, almost as if, now this is the God is speaking. This is what I did for you. I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now, this is what I want you to do for me. And then you have the listing of the law. Law, you cannot understand ancient traditions, certainly not the Bible. You cannot understand law outside of covenant. That's very important. Everybody talks about, you know, the Old Testament law. Well, you put the Old Testament law within covenant. It's part of a covenant. Also, the people entered into a covenant with their eyes open. They agreed to obey the law. They agreed. And the next characteristic of a suzerainty treaty, covenant treaty is, and if you obey, here's a list of blessings. And if you disobey, here's a list of punishment, which means that Israel agreed to enter into a covenant with God, to obey the laws that God set forth, and accepted the fact that if we are faithful, we will be rewarded. If we are unfaithful, we will be punished. So in a certain sense, if they were unfaithful, they got what they deserved. That was the mentality. Now, with that kind of understanding, you can begin to understand what a prophet is. A prophet is not somebody who looks into the future. A prophet is somebody who looks into the present and sees whether or not the people who are in covenant with God, freely in covenant with God, whether or not they are faithful to the covenant. So in a certain sense, the prophet sees how faithful we are or how unfaithful we are and calls us to fidelity. Now, so that's the first thing about the covenant. And I have there on that paper, Exodus 20. If in the future you want to look at it, you will see what I mean there. So that's the first thing in order to appreciate the prophets. Prophets are telling people whether or not they're living right. And in a certain sense, there's a very definite social dimension to that. Now, what I have listed also on this paper, there were two times in Israel's history recorded in the Bible, two times when they experienced deportation. We've heard about the Babylonian exile. There was another time when the northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrians. Now, if you're looking at me, as you are, if you're looking at the screen, I don't have a map of the ancient world. But if I did, up here would be Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is a general term. It simply means land between the rivers. And the rivers are the Tigris and the Euphrates. We know what that looks like today because the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates is Iraq. So if you can think of where, you know, the land or a map of Iraq, that's ancient Mesopotamia. And that word means land between the rivers. So Mesopotamia is here. It's a major civilization. Major civilizations, just like superpowers, always like to force their influence on the rest of the world. We're in that kind of a struggle right now. We in the West, however you understand the West, we are in that struggle with Russia. We are in that struggle with North Korea. And each one flexes their muscle. You know, we're always in a cold war. We're stronger than you are, and we'll show you our weapons. And I remember reading one time the ancient Chinese, they had a wonderful way, if this is true, they had a wonderful way of dealing with war. They would get up and dress with all of their armaments and bring all of their armaments to the war field. You only fought war on the war field. And whoever looked like they were going to win, won the battle. You didn't have to fight it. You just had to look like you could win. That's the only kind of war that works in a certain sense. And that's the kind of war we call that Cold War. Okay? So we go back. You got Mesopotamia here, right here. And then down here, I have to set up a little higher, you got Egypt, another superpower. All right? And all around these countries is desert, except for from Mesopotamia all the way down to Egypt is, it's called, you know, the ancient highway or the highway, superhighway of the ancient world. Now, Egypt is always pushing its influence up toward Mesopotamia, up the highway and the road. And Mesopotamia is pushing its influence down. And so anything that's in the middle of that is always under somebody else's control. And what's in the middle there? Canaan. Canaan, where the Israelites live. So sometimes ancient Israel was under the influence of Egypt, pushing itself up in order to meet Mesopotamia. And in a very real sense, sometimes enslaving, sometimes simply oppressing the nations that they go through. And Mesopotamia pushing down, constantly pushing down. Now, the first deportation was the Northern Kingdom. You know that ancient Israel was made up of tribes, right? And there was a time when the tribes up in the north, that's where most of the tribes were, and that's where most of the good land was. They are referred to as the northern tribes, and then down in the south where Jerusalem was with Judah, those were the southern tribes. And they were not always in union with each other. Under David, I suppose you wonder what's this got to do with prophets, bear with me. Under David, when he was king, he was able to bring together the southern tribes. He was from one of the southern tribes, Judah. And he was so successful, the people in the north sent word down and said, be our king as well. So he went up and received their allegiance. Now he is king over two different independent groups, independent of each other. But he's king of the north and king of the south. And then in addition to that, he conquers the city of Jerusalem, which is his by conquest. And he's really the king on over three political entities, and under David, they become one. But just like in the United States, you got the southern states and the northern states, and there was a civil war, all right? And even though the Yankees won the civil war, down in the south, probably still down in the south, there are loyalties that they do not give to the United States, their southern loyalties. I presume there are northern loyalties, But I live up in the north, and so I'm not always aware that what I think might be U.S. loyalties might simply be northern loyalties. Okay, so at one time, the Assyrians came down from Mesopotamia, and the first thing they hit were the northern tribes, the northern kingdom. They conquered the northern kingdom and took many of the people into exile. That's the first deportation. And notice, that happened in 721 before the Common Era, BC, before the Common Era. Almost, well, I shouldn't say almost, but around 200 years later, the same thing happened, this time with Babylon. Babylon came down and came further down. Not only went through the north, but came down to the south, conquered the southern kingdom, and took people into exile. Now, all of this is important to have some sense about what the prophets are talking about. Okay, David, would you, if you would just raise it up a little bit. Okay, fine. Now, when we talk about the prophets, this is who we're talking about. And these are all the same prophets, except in the second column under Northern Prophets. I hope you see Elijah and Elisha. Okay? These prophets do not have any books that are identified with their name, but these are very, very significant northern prophets. I'm going to look at the first column. The four major prophets, and they're considered major probably because of the size of their books, believe it or not. A small book, he would be a minor prophet. A big book, he would be a major prophet. So the major prophets, and these might be prophets that most of you have at least heard of, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. A lot of people wonder whether or not there really was a prophet by the name of Daniel. Or was Daniel, simply, there's a book that identifies itself as the book of Daniel. But there's question about just who Daniel is. All I'm saying, and that's only with scholars. The church, of course, considers, and most, when I say church, I mean the broader church, Christianity, also Judaism, consider Daniel a prophet. So those are the major prophets. And then the minor prophets are, and this is the order in which they are in the book, in at least the Catholic order in the prophets, is Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah with a question mark. He's identified as a prophet, but again, the book is really more of a fictional story. So that's why I put a question mark there. The reality of him, it's a good message. Story of Jonah. I mean, somebody gets swallowed by a whale and then is spit up on the shoreline. Hard to identify that as historical event. But that's why there's a question mark. Not is he important? Of course he's important, or at least the book is important. Whether or not there's a historical person, some say yes, some say no. Then Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Those are the minor prophets. When you go over to the second column, notice I've got the northern prophets and the first two are Elijah and Elisha. And Amos, some of them are minor prophets, but he's from the north. And Hosea is in the north, and then there's Jonah. And then you have the southern prophets. Let me read them again. Obadiah, Joel, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, Micah, Nahum, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Now, why are these men important? Were there women prophets? Yes, there were. There are a couple of named women prophets. There are no books. These are all books, with the exception, as I said, of Elijah and Elisha. And by books, I mean that their teaching, their prophecy is in books. There are some wonderful stories about Elijah and some interesting stories about Elisha. But there were women who functioned as prophets, but they did not leave behind a message, prophecy, a, a, justice points of view that these prophets did. And if, or maybe they did, and the society did not think that they were significant because they were women. Whatever the reason is, we don't have them. And of course, feminists find this very difficult. All right. But as we look at these prophets, again, I want to say, a prophet calls us all to be faithful to our religious values. That also means you've got to know what's going on in history, in politics, at the time, to know which values are being challenged. Prophets are social critics. All of them are social critics. They are saying you are not living right. All social critics are not prophets. Look at, again, I can only speak from my context, which is the United States. We've got a tremendous amount of social critics. Tremendous. Almost anybody opens your mouth, you're a social critic. But are they criticizing values or are they criticizing people? I mean, I don't know how many of you watched the president's address the other night, or was that last, whenever that was. And there were people who did not like what he was saying. And this is a serious question. Why didn't they like it? Did they not like it because, number one, he's a Democrat and they are Republicans? They are not social critics then. They're just biased critics. Did they not like it because they did not like his policies? I'd be willing to bet there's not a person in Congress today who would say, I want the poor to suffer. I want people of moderate means to pay more taxes than people who are billionaires. I can't imagine anybody wants that. They want it, however, differently. And we question about not fidelity, ideally, question not whether or not your political point of view is a valid point of view. That's valid critique. But that's my critique of contemporary politics. You get very little of that. You get criticism of the person. You get criticism of the person. He slurs his language. He doesn't finish every sentence. I mean, this is not an English class. It's the State of the Union. That's not what the Bible would identify as being prophetic. The Bible would identify as being prophetic if we as Christians value life, then the question is, do we value life generally or specifically? In other words, do we value only life that is not yet born, or do we also value life that is imprisoned, life that has created or committed terrible crimes? Do we value that life or only life of people who have not committed crimes, terrible crimes? So the question is not so much partisan politics. It's really how faithful are we to our religious values, and how do we interpret our religious values? And you cannot deny, sometimes you can get two people who value the same thing, but value it differently. And never is there a value that is by itself. It's part of a whole social framework. All right? But you cannot understand Israel's prophets if you don't understand what is the prophet speaking about. And that means you got to know its history, you've got to know its politics, and you've got to know its religious responsibilities. Not our history, not our politics, or our religious responsibility, ancient Israel's. Then we will get a sense into what the prophets are saying. Then eventually we ask another question. So this is what, let's say, Hosea is talking about. Does that speak to us today? All right. Now let's go through the second column. And just to get a sense of what some of the prophets are facing in their politics and what they say about it. If you read the stories about Elijah is the one, several wonderful stories, but there's one story about Elijah, who's one little prophet all by himself. And he lives up in the north. The north is excellent land, wonderful farming. And wherever you've got farming in the ancient world, then you have the question of fertility. Fertility is a very, very important thing. Ask any farmer. Okay, ask any farmer. So how, think about contemporary farmers. How are they going to make sure that the land is fertile? And not just for today. Sometimes we're only concerned about getting a bumper crop today. So we insert all kinds of pesticides and so on and so forth, which kills the land that you can't have it, you know, producing in the long run, just the short run. So where you have in the ancient world, fertile land, invariably, it's going to be not only a blessing, but a challenge. Because how do you ensure fertility? And in the ancient world, you ensure fertility by making sure the gods of fertility are happy. That's ancient Canaanite theology. That is not ancient Israelite theology. Well, it is in a certain sense. Israel was concerned to make sure that the God of fertility was happy, but Israel identified the God of fertility as Yahweh. Ancient Canaan identified the God as fertility as Baal, B-A-A-L, Baal. So some of the Israelites who live up in the north, who are involved in agriculture, they got a challenge. You know, they see their Canaanite neighbors with bumper crop and they want a bumper crop. So maybe they ought to offer some sacrifice to the Canaanite God, because we don't always get bumper crop from Yahweh, or at least that's their experience. They don't always get bumper crop, period. If you think they always come from Yahweh, then we don't always get it from Yahweh. So one of the things that Elijah has got to talk about and challenge the people, be faithful to the God of Israel. And the story was Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal and says, all right, offer sacrifice to Baal and see what happens. And they offered sacrifice because they were experiencing a drought. And you need water if you're going to have agriculture. They experienced drought. And so they said, pray to Baal. So they prayed and they prayed and they prayed. And Elijah said, pray louder. Your God doesn't hear you, making fun of them. Well, when it came to be Elijah's turn to pray, he prayed to God one prayer. And the heavens opened up and all the rain came down so much that everything was flooded. Very interesting stories. Did it really happen that way? It's not the point. The point of biblical stories is not primarily what does it say and what doesn't it say. It's what does that mean? What does that mean? All right. So that's the story about Elijah. So his concern was, be faithful to our God and our God will take care of you. That's pretty good theology. That's good theology even for us today, even though we're not asked to offer sacrifice so that the rain will come. But some people still do. They don't call it offering sacrifice. They call it praying for rain. And I should say it's not going to work? I don't think so. At least you get some sense of what Elijah's about. Elijah was extraordinarily political. But Elijah was too. It's a different kind of politics. And Elisha, I got to watch my time because I don't want to spend too much time on these that we can't get all the way, at least get, you know, in contact with more prophets. Elisha had to deal with politics. And in the ancient world, that meant having to deal with the monarchy. And Elisha's concern was the king of Israel, not just the people of Israel, but the king of Israel was not faithful. And again, this is a very small nation, Israel, a very small nation. So think about a very small nation in the world today. Think of a nation like the Philippines. Compared to the United States, maybe in population, that's too big a nation. But some nation that's very small, you know, and then they have to face up to, well, look what's going on in Europe with the Ukraine. Without our help, Ukraine could not stand. When I say our, I mean the West. So with Israel, a very small nation, and the king had to be faithful to God. And sometimes the king entered into treaties with other nations to hold them off so they wouldn't attack Canaan and they wouldn't attack Israel, but then they had to pay something off. And the prophets did not like that. Then you become beholden to another king and the gods of another king. That's what Elisha had to deal with government. Amos is a northern king. And again, what you find wherever you've got a bumper crop, wherever you've got agriculture, wherever you've got success, you also have the poor. The poor are with you always. And Amos criticized the people of the north, the rich of the north, who were not caring for the poor in their midst. And why should they care for the poor in their midst? And the answer is because they were all joined together in covenant with God, just like all Christians are joined together in covenant with God. It is not charity, it is justice. So Amos is condemning the rich, not for being rich. I don't know where in the Bible, Old or New Testament, where wealth is criticized. What's criticized is how you get it, and how you use it, not wealth itself. So Amos had to deal with that. Again, the economics of the society. Amos would be an extraordinarily popular or unpopular prophet today because the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting smaller. Or poor, I should say. I was thinking middle class is getting smaller. All right, that's Amos. Hosea again has to do with fertility up in the north. And Hosea uses the image of marriage. He himself was married, and the story says it was an unhappy marriage because his wife was not faithful. She was a prostitute, probably not a street prostitute, a cultic prostitute. Because if you wanted fertility in the land, fertility in the flocks, fertility in the wives, fertility in three different areas of life. We still, you know, we don't have so much problem with fertility in the land or the flocks. We still have fertility in life. You know, otherwise we would not have fertility clinics because many people still have difficulty with fertility. Well, they had it in the ancient world as well, but in the ancient world, and how do you deal with it? As I said, you pray to the God who's got power over fertility. And if it is a fertility cult, that means that men would go to the cult and have sex with a cult prostitute. Mostly women, on occasion men, would be cult prostitutes. So the issue was not the sex issue. The issue is you're going to the wrong God. Because the God of Israel is the God who has power over fertility, not the God of Baal, not the God Baal of the Canaanites. Once again, it's a social issue, because in a small society, if there's no fertility, there's no future. That's why children were valued, because of the future. And with the high infant mortality rate in the ancient world, you had to have a lot of children to ensure a future. One other little aside, the son. Everybody wanted, you know, the son, not because of testosterone is so valuable, though it is, but a son because in a patriarchal, that's head, the father is the head, patriarchal society that is patrilineal, that you inherit through the line of the father, that means you need a son to keep the land. That's why you needed a son, so that you had an heir. Because if you didn't have a male heir, your property would go then horizontally over to your brother, and it would, you'd lose the property, and the land in your family would be in your brother's family. So this is the politics of the time, and the people were always called, be faithful to Yahweh, be faithful to Yahweh, but always tempted. However, in order to be sure, I mean, that's like saying, I believe God will take care of me, but just in case, I've got a rabbit's foot. And they really, and you don't wear a rabbit's foot just because, you know, it's cosmic. I think it's cosmetic, but you really think maybe, you know, or a talisman or something. That's how Israel was dealing. Jonah, I don't want to talk about Jonah. Well, I will. The issue with Jonah was not the prophet. It was the people of Nineveh. Was a great politics, huh? It was let's say the ancient Moscow of the ancient Near Eastern world. And what the story of Jonah, which is tongue in cheek, Jonah was sent to minister and to convert, you know, to convert Moscow of the ancient world. And he didn't want to. Who wants to go and convert Moscow? If you will pardon my expression, let him go to hell, is, you know, what some people would say. So he ran away, and God used the whale to throw him back onto the shore. And then didn't those people repent? And Jonah was so unhappy because they repented. And the moral of the story, of course, is God loves everyone. God gives everyone a chance. Even the people that are our deadly enemies are loved by God. So that's the northern prophets. When we get down to the southern prophets, you've got Obadiah, who across the Jordan River were three nations, this is in the east, three nations that were hostile to Israel, not unlike 1948 when the United Nations gave this land to Israel, where Israel established itself as the state that survives today. Across the Jordan River were Arabic countries, Jordan being one of them, Arabic countries that said to Israel, we're going to drive you into the sea. That's 1948. Okay, so across the Jordan River in the ancient world were three countries that were very hostile to Israel. In fact, now again, this is the Jordan River. Okay, so the people are coming from Egypt, having been delivered at the time of Moses. And in order, instead of going up Israel on one side of the Jordan, they didn't. And there are all kinds of stories why they didn't go that way. Instead, they went further east and had to cross the Jordan River. And one of the reasons they couldn't go up is the unfriendly nations wouldn't let them in, Edom being one of them. So there's a bias against Edom at the time of Obadiah. And so what you have there is this political issue and the prophet speaking to the people how they should deal with the Edomites. Joel is a prophet that speaks about the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord, in many ways, is a day of punishment and the day of sorrow. However, you have to know a little bit about Israel's eschatology. Eschatology simply means end time, not the end of time, but end time. There's a difference. And the difference is this. Ancient Israel believed, as we do, that God made some magnificent promises. And one of the promises that God made and God continues to make, or that promise continues to urge us on, is there will be a time of great fulfillment. Live life fully and there will be a time of fulfillment. Even today, we look at our world and you think, can it get any worse? We don't ask, can it get any better? Because we hope to God it can. The question is, can it get any worse? Now, God promised it's going to get better, but it sure doesn't look like it. Sure doesn't look like it to me right now. So we've got this time, the time of great struggle and disappointment, and use any negative adjective you want. You've got this time, but then you've got the time, the age to come. And in this world, this is not dying and going to heaven. This is all in this world. There will be a day in this world where all of the suffering that we have to go through and all of the struggle will be over. So there's this world or this day and the world or the day to come. Now the challenge is, how do you get from this world to the next? And in a certain sense, great suffering. Suffering that does not destroy, but suffering that purifies. And that suffering is referred to as the day of the Lord. It is the day of the Lord of suffering, a punishment, if you will, but still it is, and the image they say, it's like a woman who is heavy with child, who is ready to bring forth, that she forgets the pain when the child is born. That image is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke when they talk about the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of time. That image is found in Revelations, in the book of Revelations, when it talks about the day of fulfillment. It is like the suffering first. And I always say, it is up to you and me to really decide whether the suffering we go through in this world, in this day, at this time, whether or not it makes us bitter or better. It's up for us to decide. There's not a person who's listening that does not have to suffer and may not perhaps even be suffering terribly right now from illness, from disappointment, from the loss of somebody that you love very much, from misunderstanding. You know, right? You know what you're going through. It's up to you and me to decide whether or not that suffering makes us a better person, more compassionate, more understanding, more patient. You don't buy this in a bottle. You cannot buy compassion. You only get it by going through. So in a certain sense, again, you have to go through hell in order to get to heaven, if you want to use that kind of language. You go through the birth pangs of the Messiah. Okay, that's what Joel is talking about. The day of the Lord will come, and it will be, we read Joel on Ash Wednesday. Joel is always the beginning of Lent. Make any kind of suffering or penance, make it worth something. Enable it to make you better, not bitter. That's what Joel is, and he calls people to that. Zephaniah, again, it's a condemnation of foreign gods. I've already talked about that with other prophets, that it just shows Israel's faced with this all the time, as are we constantly. You and I are always faced with being selfish, being challenged by our religious tradition, that we are very selfish. You and I, who are privileged, we may not be, the owner of Amazon or anything, but you and I are privileged. We don't live in war-torn country. We did not suffer an earthquake. You just want to cry. I mean, what else can happen to our world? I mean, and then the winter, and then the weather in the United States. I mean, all of this in a very real sense. You know, we're always faced with this. One thing, we finally get through it and something else comes, right? Same thing here with Israel, which means we are always called by prophetic voices, not critics of politics. They are not necessarily prophetic. They might be, but just because they are critics, political critics, does not mean they're prophetic critics. The prophetic critic is the one who criticizes us for not being faithful, not for not being Republican or not being a Democrat, for not being faithful to the religious values. We said we may not have made the promises when we were baptized, but every time you went to Holy Saturday, you renewed those promises, as did I. Every time you say on Our Father, you promise to forgive those who have sinned against you, as do I. And are we always faithful? And if we're lucky, there is someone in our life who will call us to that kind of fidelity. So, Zephaniah, condemnation of foreign gods. Micah, again, condemnation. Micah lived at the same time as the major prophet Isaiah lived, around the same time. And their message was very similar. Micah spoke about the punishment of the capital of the northern kingdom, Samaria, and the punishment of the capital of the southern kingdom, Jerusalem. Today, we might talk about the punishment of the sinfulness of Washington, D.C., which means all United States, epitomized as Washington, D.C., and Moscow. And because of the major power there and the political force used against its own people sometimes. That's what Micah spoke about. Nahum criticized Assyria that was attacking. And whenever you're attacked, you know, when you find yourself in a very vulnerable situation, fight or flight. And a lot of us run away and hide or make accommodation. That's Micah would condemn us for that. Then you've got Haggai and Zechariah, both of them condemned the people who came back from Babylonian exile, eager to rebuild the temple, and didn't realize it was going to take as long as it did and be as hard as it was, and they slacked. And both prophets condemned the people, kept calling the people, rebuild the building, rebuild the building. Malachi was very interesting, a prophet who critiqued again the infidelity of the priests and the people, but the religious leaders, the priests. You know, and there's an awful lot going on in the Catholic Church that warrants criticism, not simply pedophilia, and with the religious leaders. I must admit, and here you don't have to agree with me, but I never thought I'd see the day where cardinals would publicly criticize the Holy Father. Now, I've criticized a Holy Father. I mean, who listens to me, though? I'm not a cardinal, unless I do it in the classroom, because then I'm in a position of authority. And as a theologian, I promised to be faithful to the church. So what you've got with Malachi is criticizing the infidelity of the priests. Then we have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And they are, each one of those books is so rich. I don't know, I might be way past my time. I'm getting close to it anyway. Each one of these prophets, you know, is so filled with message. The book of Isaiah is really in three different sections. So you've got the first 39 chapters speaks about calling the people to be faithful, warning them. And if you're not, you're going to be punished. And then comes the exile and they're punished. And then what you have beginning with chapter 40 to 55 is the people coming back. Now, first of all, comforting them because of their suffering, their exile, their punishment, and then calling them to be faithful. So I must admit, Isaiah is very, very easy to identify certain things in our own culture with the needed message of the prophet Isaiah. I don't know if anybody else, David, my list fell down a little bit. I can't see on the list the other prophets, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Dan. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I have mine. Yeah, I have mine, but I don't know if everybody else does. Jeremiah, of course, ministers during the exile. So again, it's the question of, is this punishment for sinfulness? So he calls the people to be faithful. And Ezekiel and Daniel are also exilic prophets. So you've got Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, and a little bit of Isaiah, though he's not exilic. You know, it's just before the exile and just after the exile. So these are our prophets. And again, notice the importance of understanding covenant. They depend on the people of Israel promised that they would be God's people. And it presumed then, just presumed that God would take care of them. But they had to be faithful people. And if they weren't, thank God there was somebody to stand up and point the finger and say, this is what you're doing wrong, stop it. And that's what we need. And my question is, do we have it? Ideally, or in a very real sense, that's what parents do with children. That's what parents do in raising children. I don't know to what extent we are faithful. We got an easy life in this country. We Roman Catholics have an easy life. We are not persecuted for our faith in this country in the way some people are persecuted for their faith, literally ridiculed in other countries and at other times in history. I don't want to be persecuted. I'm not asking for it. But sometimes I wonder, is it been too easy for me? And that's why I'm not as faithful as maybe I could have been. But that's my own rumination. I leave you to yours. I think that's all I want to say about this. You will have a couple of minutes of break, and break up in small groups. And but then we come back in a larger group. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Okay, David, you take over.
Thank you so much, Diane. That was wonderful, tremendously insightful. Let's do take about 5 minutes break. While we're taking a break, I will put a couple questions into the chat area. And before we move into small groups, make sure you open your chat. So I have 7:24 now, Central Time. Well, let's come back together at exactly 7:30 Central Time. See you in 6 minutes. Okay. So welcome back, everybody. I know that was probably a quick 10 minutes. I'm sure you probably didn't get enough sharing amongst yourselves. We do have about 20 minutes, maybe a little less. Any thoughts, ideas, or questions that we want to start with? You want to ask Diane that came up either from her presentation or from your small groups? I invite you just use the raise hand function, which is on the menu at the bottom of the Zoom. And if you click on that menu, you'll see a bar that says raise hand. If you do that.
Or you can just go like this too.
Yeah, and then I'll call on you.
Yeah, then you're going to have to unmute yourself as well. Anyone, any questions, comments, observations? Okay.
Yes, Marion. Marion, you are going to need to unmute yourself.
Nope, can't hear. You got to unmute yourself.
There you go.
There we go. I'm so sorry. You know, you think I'd get this. But when we went into our small group, Diane, I took and prevailed on the good grace of the group to say, this is the first time I've heard you.
Yeah.
And I just am blown away. I just, what I want to do is hang up, see you guys later, and go and read with new eyes into the prophets. Right. And I would say that the way you set the tone to look at the covenant, a common statement for me is the older I get, the less I know, but the more excited I am about deepening my understanding of my faith. And thank you so very much.
It's great material.
Excited to get back to reading and really appreciating in a new way.
Good.
Ears to hear and eyes to see. You gave me that tonight. Thank you so very much.
Good, good. I think, Mike, did you have your hand up? Yeah.
A couple of things. First of all, I was about 15 minutes late, so maybe I missed this, but I was surprised not to see Nathan on your list of prophets, because he doesn't have a book, but he figures pretty prominently in 2 Samuel, for instance.
Yeah. If I would have had everybody that in a passage is identified as a prophet, there would not have been enough room. But he's not considered non-writing prophet in the same way as Elijah and Elisha are. Nathan, of course, well, Samuel is a prophet as well, you know, so there were others as well. So you're right to say that there are others, but they're not understood in the same way as the non-writing Elijah and Elisha.
Jack, your hand is up.
Yeah, Diane, thank you. My question would be, say to those of us that are preachers, lay and vowed, but, you know, there's such a lack of integrity in our country at this time, and not just in the political world, but in the corporate world and the entertainment world. How do you preach prophetically without dividing further, without polarizing a culture further?
First of all, don't think you have to preach prophetically, because then you get all wrapped up with the prophetic thing. First of all, what you have to do, but your responsibility as a preacher, and I preach on occasion, our responsibility as preachers is to know what the text is saying and calling us to, and then be faithful to that call. And I find, at least this is how I deal with it, I almost always use the pronoun we. Not you, but we. Because it's true about all of us. You know? And I find myself, I mean, what do I have to hear? I'm not that different from the average person. What do I have to hear? You know, to be smug. I mean, that's how I would handle it. And I think if we are faithful, the text, the message is prophetic. The speaker's not always prophetic. You don't have to worry about being prophetic if you're true to the message. And the message will call us to be faithful. The issue is for us, I think, is to look deeply into, and this might be how you preach it, to look deeply into the values that I uphold. Are they primarily American values? And I love being an American, but just because they're, you know, up, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's a good American value. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good Christian value though. I mean, some people don't wear shoes. I mean, how do you pull them up when they don't even have shoes that you can pull them up with, you know? So I think that we have to be very faithful about what we cherish. And look to see whether or not what appears to be good values, how do they coincide with what our religious tradition calls? I mean, one could go on and on, but I would be rambling then.
Anybody else? Yes, Clemente.
Two of them. Well, we got Don Weber even.
One of the questions that kind of was challenging to me was the whole notion of covenant and the people being in covenant with God and the responsibility that they had with each other, mm-hmm. because they were all of one accord to be you know, in relationship with God and covenant. One of our realities, I think, is that we're not always, as a people, kind of believing that we're in communion. You know, I'm not sure that the people, us are believing that we have a sense of communion with one another. And that's where there's a lack of that struggle to be faithful to a God with the people that are not in communion.
I think you have touched on precisely an example of how something that might be an American value, to be a self-made man, to be a self-made woman, that's an American value, and it's a good value. But sometimes to be self-made, I did it, you know, and it's mine, and I worked hard, and I have a right to it. That is not a communal concern. And I think you've touched on an example of how what is very definitely an American value may have some real problems, you know, if or might be in to challenge some religious values, where if you look at the Bible, you look at covenant language, it's always we. It's not singular. We, America is a very, in the West, is very individualistic. I mean, everybody knows that, individualistic. More traditional societies are more communal. Now, one is not necessarily better than the other. I'm not suggesting that, because there is a communal dimension. I mean, look at how generous people are when something horrendous happens. You will have Americans coming to help. You will have people from Germany coming to help, perfect strangers. You know, so there is a sense of communal responsibility, but frequently it's in disasters. It's not for every day. It's me and you take care of yourself. That's very American. And I may say I'm very critical, you know, but it is, it's very American. And our religion is very communal. So there you've got the rub where the values conflict. So I thank you for that observation. You're right on target.
Don Weber, you had your hand up for a second.
Yeah, Diane, thank you very much. There's a lot of voices out there and a lot of preachers, and some of them are very talented, and they just kind of grab a hold of your imagination, or they motivate you. But what is your criteria for someone that you would call a prophet in their preaching, in their message?
Well, I don't know what else to say that I didn't say to Jack, Don. I'm very concerned when people get up to preach, particularly, let's say, on the Sunday, because the average person, the average Catholic, they get their religion from Sunday preaching. Think about that. And we wonder why people don't know the faith. They get it from Sunday preaching. And that is a great concern of mine, because of the character and of Sunday preaching. I am concerned that people know what the text is saying, what the message of the text is. We are not we are not a Bible preaching community. We are a lectionary preaching community. There's a difference. We have a lectionary. We do not preach from the pulpit Bible, as some evangelical communities do, as some Lutheran communities. So we've got four biblical passages every Sunday. Four. All right, we've got the first reading. We got the psalm response is a response to the first reading. We've got some kind of instruction from Paul, and then we've got the gospel. The gospel determines the first reading. All right, so we somehow or other, people, you go 4 years of theology at CTU, you better know something about what's in the lectionary. All right, and pardon me for my bias, but that's where I come from. Okay, that's what we're doing. We are preparing people. We let them loose on the people of God, and they don't know how to preach sometimes. They preach from their spirituality. That's not enough. You may be a very spiritual person, but your spirituality is your spirituality. I have a right to hear, what does Sunday reading say to me? And I think if you are faithful to the reading, and there are any number of good commentaries, I actually have a 3-volume myself. All right, but you got any number of good commentaries on the Sunday readings. If you don't know how to do the exegesis, or you don't have time to do the exegesis, I think you've got to know what the reading says, and then you have to know, how can I bring this to the people? Because this is all their chances are, this is all they're going to get for another week. What here can help them live a good Christian life? Now, if you do that, I can assure you, you will be doing prophetic preaching. I'm not convinced thinking to get up and be critical is the answer. But if we're faithful, we will be critical. Critical of maybe the church, critical of the, without being partisan politics. I think we have every reason, if we're talking about community, I think we have every reason or right, I should say, to be critical about the fractious kind of a political situation we have in our country, and it's not all in Washington. When was the last time you were in a political conversation with somebody, and who did you rip down? I mean, we're all caught up in it. So if we are faithful, you know, to the what the reading is saying, I don't know what else we can do, Don. If we can do that, that's wonderful.
Thank you. And we have time for just one more. Mary Ann, your hand is up.
Well, I think for those who preach at church, that's really an important message. But I have a theological degree too. And I often ask myself, you know, how am I using this, you know, besides hopefully being a good example to people or with my own grandchildren or in my own family, I'm part of a very large church. And, you know, I write spiritual reflections, which we print online every week, which I think is useful. There are various groups, and I think adult education is really important. We have a book groups monthly, spiritual reading groups. I just led one of Thomas Merton's books. And I was thinking about this, it has to be ongoing, because I don't think just what they hear on Sunday is going to sustain people enough. And I don't think it's enough. And I think also a very big problem is a lot of people are just uncatechized. They really don't have the background. I was just recommending Don Senior's, you know, book, Jesus, a Gospel Portrait, because you can do it chapter by chapter, and there are questions at the end of each chapter to discuss. Now, these are usually small groups. We're lucky if we get a dozen people who come, but that's a start, and then they come back the next month. And we've tried to do a lot of this. This is in Oak Park, which I think is a, you know, a pretty active community. But I think we have to catechize adults. They will bring their children to religious ed classes, catechesis, and then just leave. You know, and if you ask for help, they don't help out, because very often they don't feel confident that they have any background. So I think we have to do more with really teaching. You know, I had Diane as a teacher way back when, and I've heard her a number of times since. I feel so, so blessed. You know, the people we had at that time, like Donald Sr., for example, and Sebastian McDonald. And I knew all these people and worked with them. Ken O'Malley was my boss. I was really, really blessed to have all this, but most people don't. So I'm just thinking how essential that is. And there are there are little courses you can take. Dominican University does that. But I wonder if we're really reaching most people with this. And we have to try hard.
Thank you so much. I think everything you said, all I can say is hooray. Very good. Thank you very much, Marianne.
Hi there, Carl.
And I want to take a moment and thank Diane. We are out of time tonight. Diane, you've just done another stellar job. I think you did even better tonight than you did last year. We'll have to sign you up for multiple sessions next time. Don, do you want to have any closing words tonight, Don Weber?
No, is it next month will be our sixth session with Robin Ryan.
And the date on that is?
I don't have it handy. Okay. It's the second Thursday of the month.
That's what we need to double check.
Yeah. But we'll send you out a notice.
He's doing something on prayer.
Yes. I'm pulling this out of my memory. It might be the 16th.
Well, I think we had to change it.
Yeah.
I got March 9th.
Yeah. Okay. The good reminder. It is the following week, because he had a conflict with the schedule. Yeah. I think I've sent out a notice, but I'll send another one out.
Okay, good. So thank you all for being here. Have a blessed evening. And we applaud you again, Diane. Great
job. Thank you very much. Good to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you,
David.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.